Maria Radio.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. A very special guest today on Church and Culture, Ibras Kassimi. He's an Iraqi. He grew up in Jordan, was educated in Amman before coming to the United States in 1994 to attend Brandeis University. Since then, Ibras has become a recognized expert in the Middle East and the issue of jihadism, and specifically the impact of jihadism on Syria, which is why I've asked Ibras to come on this show. Welcome. Welcome to Church and Culture.
Thank you very much, Adil, and I appreciate this opportunity to speak to you and your audience.
Have you ever been on a Catholic radio show before?
No, I haven't.
Well, you're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Ibras, as you know, and all country knows, wasn't too many days ago when the United States dropped 59 Tomahawk missiles on an Air Force base in Syria, which it has been said was the base from which a chemical attack was made that resulted in the deaths and the maiming of, I don't know the exact number, but maybe you can tell me, but and included many women and children. What was the number of the affected by that chemical attack?
I think there have been conflicting numbers, and also some of the wounded have sadly succumbed to their wounds, to their fatal wounds. So we're talking, I think, about 80 people.
Yes, and unfortunately there were some civilian casualties from our 59 Tomahawk missiles. And evidently, just the next day or so, they were military airplanes taking off from the same base that was supposedly destroyed by those missiles. And so this creates a very complicated situation, and that's why I've asked you to come on the show and help us to understand it. First of all, what was your gut reaction when you saw that we had sent those Tomahawks into Syria?
I felt it was an overdue show of resolve from the United States to the regime of Bashar al-Assad that this level of atrocity will not be tolerated, and that the Syrian dictator does not have a free hand in terrorizing his people. Bashar al-Assad, I would lean towards the thinking that says that he probably undertook this action because he really wanted to tell the people fighting him that you are alone and you have no friends in the world and nobody cares about what's going to happen to you, so might as well succumb surrender. That show of resolve from the United States was a game changer when it comes to that dynamic.
So in other words, the decision by Assad to use chemical warfare was not just an attempt to kill and maim, but to intimidate,
which is usually what people do with these kinds of weapons. It's more of a message rather than the effect, although the effect is horrendous. Bashar al-Assad has been using chemical weapons consistently, sad to say, even after he had entered into an agreement that was sponsored by the Russians to disarm his arsenal of chemical weapons. But the world had just stopped caring or not really following up. But something about those images, about those children, reignited the story, and apparently those images had a personal effect on President Trump, leading him to react in that way. And I feel that the reaction is warranted.
Do you recall that Secretary John Kerry under the Obama administration didn't he declare that there were no chemical weapons left in Syria?
Yes, they did, and we've been seeing news reports in recent days where there's an acknowledgement that they knew, even back then over the last few years, that the Assad regime had fudged some elements of their compliance and kept some stockpile. But it seems that the Obama administration did not make it into a priority or really do much about it, probably because they had other concerns in the Middle East.
I'm talking to Nabras Qasimi, who's an Iraqi, been in the United States since 1994, and is an expert on the Middle East, on jihadism, and all the various and very complicated religious, political, ideological currents that we Americans, I believe, still are far from even having a rudimentary understanding of, and that's why I'm so pleased he's on the show. Now, tell us about the Russian connection. I mean, I was struck by the fact that within 24 hours, Putin was arguing that the United States itself had launched this attack in order to give them an excuse to act militarily against Syria. Now, did anyone or would anyone even blink before they called that an outright fabrication?
I'm personally not familiar with this particular talking point, which would clearly be a fabrication. We just saw the press conference between the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and the Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, which just happened a couple of hours ago or an hour ago in Moscow. And the Russians are still very adamant, even after Secretary Tillerson had met with Vladimir Putin, they're still very adamant that they believe that the Syrian regime did not conduct this attack. And they're calling for an international investigation into the incident. But really, at this stage, after the Tomahawk missiles had met their targets, and after what has transpired over the last few days, we're in new territory. Whether the Russians can keep pushing the stalking point that no, it wasn't the Syrian regime or not, I think we'll be rendered mute because these investigations take a long time. Rarely do they end in with such unanimity of opinion as to their veracity and verification. And in the few months that would take to conduct such a review and investigation by an international body such as the United Nations, I think the situation on the ground would have moved much further upfield.
Now, you've written about the Middle East, and you've called it the fire pit, and you've written quite a bit about managing the fire pit under the Obama administration, but yet you're saying that we have your game changer, we have a new situation. How has the fire pit, as you described it, changed after the Tomahawk attack on the Syrian Air Force Base?
Well, during the Obama years, much of what U.S. policy or thinking regarding or coming out of the White House regarding the Middle East was in question. People were scratching their heads. And it wasn't until last year, in an interview that, or series of interviews that President Obama had conducted with Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic magazine, that resulted in this big essay called The Obama Doctrine, written by Goldberg. I think he published it in April 2016. Did we finally have it in the president's own words, what he was thinking all this time throughout both terms of his presidency? And it was, simply put, the Middle East shouldn't or doesn't matter that much for U.S. strategic interests as it had in the past. And he was downgrading its prioritization among the issues that America should spend blood and wealth, blood and treasure in maintaining stability over, or hegemony over, or control over, whichever way you want to look at it. And what has changed, I believe, with this attack in Khan Sheikh, the chemical attack, and the swift, quick, and dramatic response from President Trump, is that we are at a departure point. Once again, the Middle East is going to witness the engagement of a U.S. president directly, giving it what seems to be more priority. And it seems that since then, President Trump is signaling that maybe he's not going to go in full bore into Syria, as Secretary Mattis has put it, the Secretary of Defense. But he certainly is very interested in reaching some sort of large settlement of the Middle East that would even include something like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Now, you can't talk about what kind of priority the Middle East has in our foreign policy without mentioning the state of Israel. And if I were to try to translate this Obama doctrine into a kind of shorthand, I would say, hey, we are not going to be as involved in the defense of Israel as we have in the past, and we are not going to state our foreign policy primarily in terms of our support of Israel.
Israel is a principal ally of the United States in the Middle East, but there are also very other important allies, such as Turkey and Saudi Arabia. So Israel is part of this. There's an emotional attachment by Americans with Israel. There's a strategic attachment. It's an old relationship. But I think the thinking that President Obama was approaching it with was that you can maintain that attachment, you can maintain the security of Israel without having to really play on all fronts in the Middle East. And his detachment from the Middle East, although it annoyed the Israeli leadership, but what it really did was, or what the more acute reflection of it was, on the Saudis and the Turks, who were watching the events transpire in Syria, waiting for American leadership, leadership that never came.
Yeah, and by the way, I don't mean to beat the drum for Israel. I'm not, you may be surprised to know, but I'm one of the few Catholic conservative Republicans who's critical of the state of Israel, especially in their, you know, military occupation of the West Bank that has gone on decades too long. But I'm really interested in the fact that you said that both Turkey and Saudi Arabia were waiting for this kind of action. Now, how does that connect to the various strains of the Islamic faith that are in constant conflict in the Middle East? Try to explain to our listeners just how the Shia-Sunni split really has to be understood in order to understand the Middle East.
The Shia, let's put it this way. The Shia-Sunni split is today a critical motivator of passions, strategic determinations across the region. More so today than it was, let's say, 20 years ago. But that doesn't mean that even back then it wasn't an important factor. But today it is really right up there with the big motivators. The Shia Sunni split, at its heart is a political split, which goes back to the foundational years of Islam. And specifically, it revolves around the political question of who should succeed Muhammad after he dies. There's 1,400 years worth of history of back and forth between the two sects, and it has taken on different iterations and different definitions and different guises, but today both Sunnis and Shiites feel as if they're in an existential battle over survival in the Middle East because of these kinds of identity politics.
Now, I'm assuming then that Turkey and Saudi Arabia are on the same side with that split.
On this issue, and as much as it motivates them, they'd be on the same side. However, they have their own differences, or they could have their own differences. They have their own approaches to the problem. In Saudi Arabia, for example, if we look more specifically at this issue, the Saudi Arabians look at this case of the Sunni-Shiite split and see an expanding sphere of Iranian hegemony across the region. What it means directly for them is that in the eastern part of Saudi Arabia, which is a region that was annexed by the House of Saud only in 1913, there's a large Shia minority over there, and that's where most of the Saudi oil happens to be. So in their determination of what this means to them, it means that, or what Iranian hegemony expansion might mean to them, it might mean that one day Iran would foment either unrest or sedition or even secession or even occupation to take away that eastern section away from
the Saudi. And of course, they belong to the Shia side.
That area of Saudi Arabia has many areas of it, many pockets of it, a Shia plurality.
Now I'm talking about Iran.
Iran is a Shia state.
Yeah. So give us the basic lineup. Who's on the Shia side and who's on the Sunni side in terms of states?
Iran turned into a majority Shia country about 600 years ago. And Shiism has colored its identity, has defined its identity, especially versus another important Sunni power back at that time, which was the emerging Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire went to war against Safavid Iran, which was Shia Iran, but that's part of the history. Today, the capital of the Ottoman Empire was Constantinople. Today, Constantinople is in Turkey. Turkey can count to be on the Sunni side, even though Turkey has a sizable heterodox Shia community within it. And then you have important Shia populations in the Persian Gulf, in countries such as Kuwait. They're a majority in the island of Bahrain, and they have pockets in other places like the Emirates and Qatar. They wield important real estate, especially in terms of oil wealth, in eastern Saudi Arabia. Iraq is a majority Shia country, and until recently, the Shia were disenfranchised from politics. But in 2003, when Saddam, who was Sunni, was overthrown, the Shiites got to power through the ballot box and clung on to it. And then you have Syria and Lebanon that finish off this picture, or why it's important, because Syria you have another heterodox Shia group, the Alawites.
So I thought they're not, the Syria is not a Sunni country?
Syria is a majority Sunni country, but there is a group there, which is the Alawites. They're not mainstream Shias, but they're close enough, and they're about 15% of the population, maybe a little less. And they've been in control of Syria, in control of the security apparatus, and the president of Syria today, Bashar al-Assad, is from his sect, as was his father. And then you have an important Shia community in Lebanon, the principal political actor of which is Hezbollah.
So it's interesting that, so Syria, the fact that you have these Alawites in Syria, does that make Syria kind of on its own in terms of this religious divide?
Very relevant. This divide is very relevant to the story of Syria and what we call today the Syrian Civil War. It had, when the regime was, when the Assad regime was challenged through peaceful demonstrations, largely peaceful demonstrations in 2011, that were an echo or a reverberation of the Arab Spring, the regime chose to hit back in a brutish and brutal manner, and they chose to mobilize regime supporters on a sectarian basis. And to tell the Alawite community of Syria that this is not a democratic or a benign call for reform and protest and change, that this was a sectarian existential menace whereby the Sunnis seek to take revenge against the Alawites.
So these were Sunni rebels in Syria.
Well, back in 2011, we were still not speaking of a rebellion. We were speaking of a protest movement.
Yeah. Well, who tell us how it went from a protest movement to a rebellion?
Well, I would describe it in such a way. I'm sure other scholars might have different impressions of this. It changes into rebellion to match the nature of the regime's response. So the regime decides to start shooting bullets. The people on the other side decide to shoot bullets back. And that's when it turns into a rebellion. And a very important phase of it was that you had a lot of Syrian soldiers deciding that they don't want to shoot against their own people, and they defected.
Kind of like the French Revolution.
Excuse me?
Kind of like the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution.
Yes, and they defected, and they started forming themselves into the Free East Syrian Army units to contest the battlefield with the regime forces.
Now, at the time, what was the United States policy toward this rebellion?
The United States policy was mostly along these lines. They would like to see Assad go, but they were not prepared to tip the scales in the favor of these rebels. So the thinking back then is that we don't really know who these people are. It's a fast-moving picture. Libya was happening at the same time. Egypt was in turmoil. it seems that the whole Middle East was going through a fever. And I think it was the inclination of President Obama, based on what we later came to describe as the Obama doctrine, whereby he doesn't see that the Middle East is that important. It was a determination made was maybe we can sit this one out. And in this fast-moving picture, maybe Assad will be overthrown without us having to get embroiled or enmeshed in this situation.
So,
But I think that was short-sighted, because even back then, even at that time, you had voices such as my own and many others warning that Syria presents a unique opportunity for elements, for really bad actors like the jihadists, to take advantage of the chaos unfolding there and the sectarian, the evolving sectarian nature of the conflict there in order to come back to life.
And that's exactly what happened, isn't it? And we've got to take a short break. This is fascinating and lucid. Thank you very much, Nebras. We're talking to Nebras Kazemi about Syria and the Middle East in general so that we can understand the importance of the Tomahawk attack of a week ago. We'll be back after this short message.
On the Saturday before Holy Week, Father Ben Lucky spoke to the parishioners at St. Anastasia Church in Troy, Michigan about preparing themselves for Holy Week.
It really is the most pivotal and important week, not only of the year, but it really should be the most important week of our lives. And the reason is because we need to enter into it in such a way that we change fundamentally. We can't go through a Holy Week and remain the same. If we do, there's something wrong, because we as Catholics don't see it like everybody else. What we as Catholics do is enter into the mystery.
We have prayed our way through the Triduum and celebrated Christ's death and resurrection. All of that happened so quickly that most of us are left in a fog. Join us on our next program as Father Ben Lucky takes us back to prepare once again for Holy Week. Listen to Putting on the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak. You've heard it said that children are resilient, but it turns out that's not as true as we might like to think. A study in the journal Clinical Neuroimaging reports that children who experienced common family stressors like a lack of affection, marital problems, or poor communication experienced less development in the brain regions responsible for impulse control and stress regulation than did children who were raised in homes without similar stressors. The study is a wake-up call for moms and dads to attend to marriage and parenting struggles promptly. Currently, many couples wait 4 to 6 years before getting professional help. Knowing the effect that marriage and family stress has on our children's developing brains can hopefully encourage parents to get help sooner rather than later. To encourage good impulse control and stress management in our kids, the most important parenting technique is providing our children with a loving, affectionate, peaceful home life. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
I am back with Nebras Kazemi, who is a Iraqi, came to the United States in 1994 and has written all kinds of things about the Middle East. He has a what he describes as a monograph from Hoover Institution called Syria Through Jihadist Eyes, A Perfect Enemies, currently writing a book about the Middle East, which from what I can tell at this during this conversation is going to be fantastic and much needed. Nebras, if you were on the Middle East desk in the State Department reporting to Secretary Tillerson and to the President, what would be your advice for United States policy in Syria going forward from this attack?
I would be, to begin with, before I open my mouth, be mindful of two things. One is the general receptivity of the American public to to military action in the Middle East.
Yeah, by the way, his popularity popped up 6 points after this.
Yeah, but I mean, specifically also, the president has to worry about certain elements of his base feel that really the U.S. should wash its hands of the Middle East. That is a real part of the sentiment there. Second of all, when you look at all the damage that has happened to a place like Syria after 6 years of civil war, for example, the city of Aleppo, much of it is in ruins. This was Syria's economic capital, probably by population. Before the war, it was Syria's largest city. And much of it is in ruins now. So one had to factor in who's going to pay for rebuilding this place, for making it habitable again, for bringing back some sort of economic viability for it.
Do we need a Marshall Plan? Do we need a kind of Marshall Plan?
Yes, but I don't think the American public is, or even the president. Is inclined to do that, probably rightly so, because the United States has its own priorities and its own things that it would like to fix about itself and pay for. And the price bill for Syria would be just very, very large. So, given these two very important things, I think there was something important that the Obama administration, even though they were unwilling to do much about Syria, but for some reason passed on, which was a commitment from the Saudis and the Turks to go into Syria. Now, bringing in even more actors into the Syrian drama might not seem like a good idea. But if the Turks are committed to putting in their troops in Syria and fighting the Islamic State, or what we know also as ISIS, and the Saudis are also willing to do the same against ISIS, then by all means come in and be part of the kinetic force that defeats ISIS. Getting rid of ISIS gets rid of one of the components of the Syrian tragedy. But the other component is what to do about the regime of Bashar al-Assad. But that can be resolved through a negotiation with that regime, whereby the Assad or Bashar himself phases out his rule. And some sort of accommodation is reached with his top generals and the top financiers of his regime, so that they don't feel very threatened by the future, and then people can move on and have regional actors like the Saudis and the Gulf countries begin paying for the rebuilding of Syria, and the United States can be there to provide logistical help, to provide air cover, to provide the role of an honest broker. The United States can reach their own deals with the Russians in order to have them be less of a complicating factor in the Syrian.
Do you think Assad and Putin will allow that to happen?
Assad, I mean, when this unfolds, Assad, I don't think it's much of a vote, but Putin might be attracted to this offer, because at the end of the day, let's just say that the United States does nothing and the regional actors do nothing. And Assad, over a number of years, manages to recapture much of the territory that he's lost, and then he finds some sort of rapprochement or a deal with the Syrian Kurds, allowing them autonomy or federalism. The Russians are sitting there feeling all smug that they saved the regime of Bashar al-Assad. But then, the bill arrives, and who's going to pay for it? And I don't think the Russians can afford it. And Syria in ruins is no great prize for anyone, either for the Assad family or for Putin.
Well, who is Assad actually fighting now? I mean, who is left? How many of rebels are there left? Isn't this conflict now down to local pockets of resistance, or is there still a broad base of rebellion in Syria?
Allow me just to go back to the year 2009. So in 2009, I write this monograph, Syria Through Jihadist Eyes. Nothing is happening in Syria. Everything is running very well. Bashar al-Assad is firmly in control. The Obama administration is signaling in a very big way that they want to seek a very deep bond of friendship with Assad. Assad's relationship with the Gulf states, with the Saudis and the Turks is excellent. Everything is going very well for Assad. Yet I was looking at the situation, and something seemed off to me. It seemed as if there are underlying stresses within that regime that would make it a bad bet to bet on the stability of the regime. But I was a very minority voice. Things looked very good for Assad, and looked as if lots of people were going out of their way to try to normalize his autocracy and normalize his rule and accept him as a regional actor of standing on the international scene. And even though I had this inclination, this feeling that maybe things are not as solid as they were, when I started seeing those protests in 2011, seeing those YouTube videos of Syrians tearing down the pictures of Papa Assad, Bashar's father, to me that was startling, shocking. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have imagined that something as affirming, as hopeful, as powerful as such images coming where regular Syrians were breaking the bonds of fear and demanding rights and putting out slogans, asking for democracy, asking for human rights, asking for all these, these utopian ideals, good ideals. To me, it was a shocker. And there was a moment of hope. There was a real moment of hope whereby Syria, like other places in the Middle East, like Egypt, like Tunisia, like Libya, all right, were embarking on something completely different, completely new.
A true Arab Spring.
A true Arab Spring. I can say the same for Egypt. For a few months during that beginning of 2011, I just had my mouth open most of the time, in awe of what was going on. And I thought I knew quite a lot about what was going on in the Middle East, yet I was taken by surprise. And I think a lot of people who have studied the Middle East over a long time were taken by surprise. And these were good times. Now, at that moment, when we were talking about who does Bashar al-Assad, who was he fighting in Syria, at that moment he was fighting, nurses, school teachers, plumbers, who were coming out into the street and just demanding first-class citizenship, demanding the right to vote, demanding that they shouldn't accept as a given nepotism or sectarian hegemony. Or,
a dictatorship by the family and friends, right?
Exactly, and sect, all right? That there could be a possibility of a very different kind of Syria. And that was a hopeful moment. At that moment, those were the people that he was fighting. The more he fought those kind of people, and the more these people were killed, were pushed out of their homes, out of their cities, forced into exile or refugee camps, the more that he spilled blood, you had the sense that, you know, you need to match fire with fire. You had the kind of radicalism of the regime started reflecting on the people who were rising up against the regime. And in that context, especially with the sectarian sentiments, especially with the natural desire of people to seek revenge, and what happens when people get very angry. And you had actors like the jihadists who were willing to take advantage of the situation. So you had this slow, gradual, yet inevitable erosion of what Syria could have hoped for into the darker visions of the jihadists and what they had in mind. Jihadists like the Islamic State, ISIS, jihadists like other organizations that pledged fealty and allegiance to Al-Qaeda, and other shades of Islamist extremism that are spreading.
So exactly what you feared.
Today when people say that Bashar al-Assad is fighting extremism, that's true. Today he is fighting these kinds of Salafist, extremist Islamist groups, or groups that are aligned with Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State, ISIS. But in a large measure, he enabled their emergence through his tactics, through his dictatorship, through his brutality. And at the critical time when he could have seen what was happening in Syria and decided that rather than shoot his own people, he would exit the presidential palace, seek exile, or really begin deep-rooted reform of the state and democratize, he chose to go another route, and that choice of his is the reason that today we have these really horrible, horrible actors opposing him on the ground.
Do you think he ever seriously considered abdicating?
Well, now we know not, all right? But see, something that haunts me is that had there been just a little bit more of a muscular show from the Obama administration, let's say the first time Syrian Air Force was used to begin bombing a village that was demonstrating or was being too rowdy against the regime. First time a barrel bomb was used, the United States said, "We're going to hit the first fighter jet that starts hitting civilians, a Syrian fighter jet that hits civilians." I think that would have created a whole different calculus amongst the generals and security dons who surround Bashar al-Assad. When they didn't see the U.S. doing that, they made the calculation, I believe, in their head that we have to fight this through, or we can fight this through, and we might actually be winning. Had they seen a different message, I think they might have, even if he wasn't, didn't have the inclination to resign or to abdicate, they would have, these kinds of generals would have made it very clear that this is going to be a losing fight, and let's cut our losses and let's see what deal we can get through a negotiation.
Talking with Nebras Kassimi about Syria, about the Middle East, about Obama policy, and now what appears to be a new policy from Donald Trump. Do you think there'll be another chance at getting rid of Assad?
I don't know how to answer that question. Because of decisions taken in the past, decisions taken by Bashar Assad, decisions taken by regional actors, decisions taken by the Obama administration, today we've arrived at a point that is very, very complicated in Syria. And going forward, there's not going to. I don't see a resolution to the Syrian problem, at least if people are trying to resolve it quickly and with less sorrow and disaster ensuing. That doesn't factor in that Bashar al-Assad needs to leave power.
Do you think Syria will deliberately challenge President Trump because of this Tomahawk attack?
I think Syria is going to sit right now very tight, watch what the Russians might be saying, watch what the Iranians might be saying, and if they see that the Tomahawk attacks are going to entail continued presidential engagement with the Middle East, and might lead to the Trump administration putting together a far larger package whereby they bring regional actors such as Turkey and Saudi into the foreign land in Syria. I think the Bashar regime would get the message that this is a very different playing field, and they need to resign themselves to the idea that they'll need to make concessions in negotiation in upcoming.
So you would say that the Tomahawk attack is definitely a net benefit to the United States, to Syria, and to the region in general.
What I believe is the case, which is very different from what many observers in Washington are saying. What they're saying is that they're asking, what is next? That the conversations about what comes next in the Trump administration are more advanced than how they're being characterized. There are competing visions of what the U.S. is going to do in Syria and across the Middle East, but it's these. One should not think that this is an off-the-cuff reaction, a gut reaction to pictures of to images of suffocating babies. It might, but I believe that there's a context to it. The Middle East has been talked about extensively in the White House, and I think there is a vision, or at least two visions, at play now, and the president will be choosing amongst one of them over the next couple of months.
Talking once again, I want to remind our listeners that I'm talking with Nebraska Kasimi, and he has a website. It's talisman-gate.com. That's Talisman, talisman-gate.com. And you will find some of his writings there. You can also look in the archives of the New York Sun, where he wrote a column for many years, Atlantic, Hudson Institute, Hoover Institute. Your writing is pretty much all over the place, DeBras.
Yes, it is. But for much of the Obama administration, I had stopped writing. And I went into the private sector in the Middle East, mostly because I really didn't sense that there was much of a conversation in the United States about the Middle East, and that the Obama administration had made up its mind early on about the region. So even when there was something as seismic as the Arab Spring, it was my sense that because of the earlier things, it's just a manifestation of the policy we'd seen from the bottom, that not much was going to happen. So I wasn't very hopeful. But let's see, in the last year or so, I've been hopeful that a new administration would feel compelled to do something more about the Middle East. And to be truthful, I am hopeful about what President Trump might do for the region.
Do you think that Barack Obama's own religious background had anything to do with his Obama doctrine on the Middle East?
His upbringing overseas, the types of company he kept, I mean, it's all very cosmopolitan and worldly, and he might have felt that he had seen more of the world than many of his peers while growing up back in Hawaii or when he went to college. So he might have approached this really from a position of that he personally knows a lot about this and more about this than many people, and his own worldviews had taken shape a long time before the presidency.
So there's a certain amount of arrogance, or do you think that was just was that a legitimate attitude of his?
It's really not for me to say. That's going to be something his biographers handle. I look at the end result. There are opportunities missed. What he believed were lessons learned, for example, from Iraq, I don't think he learned them very well. There was too quick of a judgment, too much of an inclination to believe that he learned or he knew what he knew. And even within his own administration, there were lots of voices, or so we're told now in retrospect or retroactively, where people pushed back and were trying to get the president more engaged or the United States more engaged in the region. For example, the issue of the red line in 2013, when Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons, even though President Obama before that had said that would be crossing a red line that would compel the United States towards action. And then after it happened, the president chose not to do anything about it. And then he felt that that was one of his best decisions or better decisions of his presidency. So even within his own administration, even with the pushback from some of the people around him, it really is a case where it was the president's choice. It was him determining that this was the best course of action for the United States. And it might be too soon to pass judgment on a legacy, but if you listen to what former Obama administration officials have been tweeting out or writing recently, and they're doing so at a feverish pace, they're much in a hurry to declare themselves having been right all along and to validate that legacy very quickly. But what I say, it's too early, but from the initial look of things, it looks as if their approach or their policy towards the Middle East was that doesn't look good, let's put it that way. And it seems that a lot of what President Trump had to do is to correct that and resolve it.
Brass, we've come to the end of our time. I want to thank you for being a guest on Church and Culture, and I feel like it would be great to have you back and continue to explore this the situation and your clarity and your willingness to, you know, talk the basics of the situation about the Middle East with all of us. Really appreciate it. I want to thank you for that.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. It was a pleasure speaking to you.
And again, you can read more of Ross Kazemi's articles at his website, talisman-gate.com. And thank you again to Bross. And for those of you who are listening, we'll be back with another wonderful guest after this short break.
Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
Okay, what if he really doesn't understand why he's being disciplined? Well, that's a legitimate question. As a matter of fact, it's probably the dominant question in early disciplining. How much does a 16-month-old understand anyway? If he spits at you and you sit him on the steps, does he really understand why he shouldn't spit? No, he doesn't. All he knows is he's being sat on the step. He doesn't sit there and think, well, in any kind of socially reciprocal interaction, I think a mutual interface would be something that would be appropriate. Therefore, I can understand that magnitude of disrespect being a complete and total turnoff for my mother. No, all he knows is that mommy looked upset and put him on the steps and said, "You spit, you sit." If you had a dog, would you wait until the dog understood not to urinate on your carpet before you trained him not to urinate on your carpet? Oftentimes, in early discipline, when those kids are between 1 and 2 years of age and we are just starting to teach, if A, then B, they don't understand. In time, they'll come to understand. They will realize that certain behaviors have certain results. And with even more years, they will internalize the reasons for this. And those internal reasons will act as a self-regulating mechanism. But when we begin discipline, a good part of the time, we ask the question, what if he doesn't understand? We can legitimately answer, I'm not sure he does. But that's okay. The teaching must begin. I'm Dr. Ray.
Are we always obliged to obey our conscience? The Catholic Catechism asserts that we are always obliged to obey the certain judgment of our conscience, and that if we deliberately act against a good conscience, we condemn ourselves. On the other hand, our moral conscience may remain in ignorance, and thus we can make erroneous judgments about acts performed in the future or those performed in the past. If ignorance is caused by personal responsibility or negligence, we are culpable of the sin we commit. Some of the causes of erroneous judgment can be ignorance of Christ and his gospel, bad examples of peers, enslavement to one's passion, rejection of the church's authority and her teaching, lack of conversion and lack of charity. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
On the next Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
We'll keep you closely connected to the faith with the latest from Rome, the front lines of the pro-life movement, and we'll also take a look at other crucial issues facing you and your family and our one holy Catholic and apostolic church.
Catholic Connection, weekday mornings at 8 a.m. on 990 WDEO.
For professional golfer and homeschool graduate Amy Anderson, the secret to success is no secret at all. Hear Amy's advice for young athletes on today's Homeschool Heartbeat with your host, Mike Smith. Hear the answer on today's Homeschool Heartbeat.
Amy, being a professional athlete is something many kids dream about, but very few attain. What do you think were the biggest reasons for your success as an athlete?
Well, first off, I am so blessed to be able to do this as a career. I can't even tell you how many people have been behind me and opportunities that have just opened up. But, you know, the other side of it is what Thomas Edison said, and he said, opportunity is missed by most people because it wears overalls and it looks like work. And there's no question I've put in a lot of hard work over the last 15 or so.